You're listening to the program Saskia Unreserved on RIC Classic. My very special guest, the head of psychosocial services of the Cyprus Anti-Cancer Society, Tina Rosidou. Thank you so much for being here in the studio with me.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here, Saskia.
I wanted to begin with the psychosocial issues, events or disruptions in a person's life, including housing concerns, financial matters, domestic abuse, grief and loss, isolation. But probably the most devastating is to hear a diagnosis of the big C. Although cancer incidence has increased globally, mortality has actually decreased. So it isn't all bad news. And I'm very happy to have you here to discuss this today, because the biopsychosocial model suggests that medical professionals' understanding of how psychosocial factors influence the entire course of cancer is critical. It's not only the patients, but also survivors, their caregivers, oncology professionals who face psychosocial challenges. And I wanted to begin by elaborating a little on what happens when a patient receives that first diagnosis.
Yes, I think even before the diagnosis comes, it's a very difficult period when the investigation happens. So if somebody even thinks they might be facing a difficult, a difficult diagnosis, because they've had symptoms or they've had things, they know something's wrong.
There's a sort of inner understanding, intuition.
It starts in terms of triggering fear or what else is going on in their life and who else it might affect if they are sick, if they are going to be getting a diagnosis for a life-threatening disease.
Yes.
So I think it starts from before.
Right.
And a person might feel a lot of anxiety or changes in mood right up to the diagnosis.
Mm. Different stages entail different problems and demands. What about, and I want to go through some of these, what about the notion of self-concept and the gap between actual self and the ideal self?
In terms of
For example, the physical and physical symptoms. For example, someone who's had a mastectomy, it's something very visual.
Of course, yes.
Maybe not to the outside, but to her.
Yes, and it's such a wound. It's a narcissistic wound, first of all. Any kind of impact it has on our self-image, any kind of impact it has on our how we perceive our body. Of course, a lot of the times there are effects afterwards.
Yes.
After the you bring up mastectomy, sometimes certain things, certain procedures may also leave some long-term problems.
Right,
such as mastectomy. You mentioned that, so I can just elaborate a little bit of that. It might mean that a lot of the lymph nodes have been removed, so we need to go into more conversations with the patient about how to take care of their arm, how to take care of the area, there needs to be a lot of change happening. You know,
yes,
they can no longer lift weights, and this is for life.
Yes.
So a lot of the times when you talk about self, is who is this new self under the circumstances after a procedure? So
I think many people don't realize that this is a long term. Once you've had cancer, you're always up for screening, checking.
Yes, screening and checking should be happening even before cancer and, of course, after cancer. You need to be at least for 10 years under the guidance of a supervising clinician, an oncologist, because you need to be doing your annual checks, your CT scans, your MRIs, yes, whatever it is that the oncologist does. And then after that period, it's not forever. Of course, you need to be conscious of things, but we'd like for people to actually leave cancer behind and get on with their life and not always have, you know,
that's the part of the psychology.
Patient,
yes. We said about mastectomy, and how, for example, would you approach that as opposed to a man having prostate cancer, one of the most frequent and prevalent forms, but also one of the most curable?
Both of them are.
Both
breast cancer and prostate cancer are the most curable, I would say.
Yes.
And thyroid cancer. We have lots of cancers now that are curable.
Yes.
The point is not to hone in on the certain cancers, but to encourage people to do their tests beforehand, to kind of keep an eye on their bodies, because what's most important is to catch it early.
It's very important that you actually said
that. And that's why we have such an enormous number of cancer survivors. It's very important to catch it early. It's very important to go and do your pap test. It's very important to do your to go to the urologist and check prostate and thyroid and, you know, anything that gives a symptom. Needs to be checked.
Yes.
Not
to leave it.
Skin cancer, if you have a mole that wasn't there before.
It's interesting that you say that, because skin cancer is also deadly.
And
some skin cancers are deadly. Too often that particular cancer, and I'm looking forward to actually speaking to a dermatologist later in the year about this. Too often, it's not paid sufficient attention to it. And this is in antithesis to what you've said of how important it is to actually catch it early.
Well, the first thing is to know your body, to be able to scan your body and see if there are any changes. Because with age, changes come anyway, from being a child to being an adolescent. Developmental stages also bring changes in your body. And then, of course, premenopause in women, menopause afterwards, same many hormonal changes in men in their 40s, 50s, 60s.
Yes.
A lot of changes happening. So it's doing the self-exams if you're a woman for catching breast cancer, checking your skin and making sure you are aware of any changes.
Yes.
And then if a change is happening, you know, everybody's got a GP now. There's no excuse. We have YSE. Everybody can go and we have a general health system.
Right.
Everybody has access to healthcare now. So it's just being brave enough to go and show it to someone, have the conversation, and get it checked out.
We're talking more about older people, but what about younger people and especially children with cancer? This is very heartbreaking. I think
Absolutely.
It pulls at everybody's strings. How often do you find that parents have caught the cancers early enough so that children can live a cancer-free life? And is your approach to the psychosocial approach different with children?
Well, we don't actually work with children at the society. The two societies are for adults, and there are people working with childhood cancers.
Why is that? Is that a specific reason for that?
Our society 50 years ago started off as adult care society, and perhaps there weren't that many cases 50 years ago. I'm not really sure. But the approach definitely would be different. And I don't have any statistics with me, but I would think there are a lot of curable childhood cancers.
All right.
A lot of survivors from childhood
cancer.
So for
this conversation, then, we're not speaking about childhood cancers. We're speaking about adult cancers. Sexual dysfunction is identified as one of the most common causes of distress amongst cancer patients. What kind of supportive care do you offer?
Mm-hmm.
What is your approach?
Definitely a major issue after someone who's gone through cancer, and it depends what kind of cancer, and it depends what the dysfunction is. A lot of the times it's short-lived, and with counseling and with a multidisciplinary approach. So if it's but a lot of the times it can be permanent damage because of anti-cancer, not medications, but radiotherapy or chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. High toxicity medication, depends on the age of the individual, especially if a man who's gone through prostate cancer, there might be some permanent damage and permanent issues.
Like erectile dysfunction.
Erectile dysfunction, right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Premature ejaculation, women who have gone through breast cancer, and then very young women are often have to undergo menopause at a much younger age because it might be
right.
The hormonal changes that the oncological team may start hormone therapy. They might have to stop their periods. So it's a huge issue. It's not talked about enough.
Yes.
I agree. The Europe has actually started a big campaign for all the European countries for people to get educated more, oncologists, psychologists,
you preempted my next question. Is there enough information?
Well, actually, this year is the big campaign all across Europe. So we're hoping there's a lot of information that's being generated right now and training programs that I think everybody who works with cancer patients needs to take one of these courses. A lot of the difficulty is having the conversation. So because it's not a high priority, a lot of the times in the medical establishment, they're not actually asking the questions. This is the feedback we've had from our patients. And it depends on the culture too.
Yes.
Our male patients with prostate issues are a lot more forthcoming to us there. Urologist or oncologist about their sexual life. A lot of the women, though, aren't asking. They're not really having the conversation.
Do you think that has anything to do with the psychologist that they see? And I also want to ask you...
It has to do with cultural norms as well.
Mm.
And
still a taboo subject?
It's a taboo subject for certain age groups, not for everyone. Of course, you know, much younger women are more comfortable talking about it. Our older generation might not be as comfortable to speak about it with their oncologist.
Do you think...
Because it's not given a priority either.
Do you think that social media has any impact on that? And because of information being available on the internet, there's a hesitancy to ask?
I would think that social media has a positive impact on one side on this issue, because I think a lot more information from all over the world is arriving at our tablets and our telephones. And a lot of conversations are happening on our screen and we can just observe them. And then it can trigger our questions in us, and perhaps we'll take it to our doctor or our psychologist or our social worker, whoever it is, and discuss it. Or at least bring it up with our partners. Social media is very powerful for educating if the information is correct. So
yes.
I think it could be used.
Very important that the information is actually correct.
Yes, yes.
As well.
And it is coming through from organizations who have a scientific basis for these things. Mm. So I think it depends what sources of information everybody's looking at.
Right.
But there's lots of cancer societies that are putting out a lot of valuable information. Most of it is in English, unfortunately, so it depends.
Yes.
But there's lots of easy ways to, you know, translate info.
A patient who receives the diagnosis of cancer, what happens after that? Are they referred to you as a suggestion, and then you as the head of the psychosocial services actually disseminate a psychologist to sit one-on-one with them? Give us a little overview of what you actually do and what's available to somebody who's been diagnosed.
Okay. Our society is palliative care and supportive care society. Mm-hmm. So there are home care teams in every city across the country. And there's a palliative care center in Nicosia with 26 beds for inpatient care. So there's outpatient, which is home care, and there's inpatient.
Palliative care, I would say, is towards the end of life?
No, that's the old definition of palliative care.
Please and we're correct trying, me. Yes.
We're trying to kind of send the message that palliative care has shifted, and it's really important to get this message out.
Thank you.
Because 20 years ago when I started in this care, palliative care was starting to say, you know, it's not right, it's not at the end. That's end of life care, which is a part of palliative and oncological care. So it's no longer one and the same. Palliative care starts with the day of diagnosis because it starts to be side by side with oncological care. So we, the palliative care clinicians, will look at a patient holistically, and that's where you're going to need to see the psychosocial, because a lot of oncology centers don't have psychosocial care or don't have teams. They might have one psychologist or one social worker.
I was going to say,
but for 4,000 new diagnoses per year in Cyprus, it can't be a one-man show. So palliative care, which is offered to cancer patients in Cyprus across the whole country, whether inpatient or outpatient, should start. The referral should be early referral at the beginning of diagnosis. And it doesn't end with death like it used to, because the psychologists and the social workers will work with certain families through their bereavement process. Now, out of all the teams, there are now established teams of social workers and psychologists in each city. The referrals, some referrals come externally, like you said, like they might come from the oncologist or the oncology center, so they might come from an oncological nurse, but a lot of them come internally. So once the home care team has been dispatched, whether it's a nurse or a doctor or a physiotherapist, they'll also see signs of distress, and they can also send a referral to us. We don't need to get a referral only from a doctor. We can get a referral from anybody.
You've got 26 beds in Nicosia.
Yes.
How many patients have you got?
Today, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Give me a ballpark figure.
Okay, Cyprus as a whole should have 50 palliative care beds as total country. And we have 26 in Nicosia. There's another center in Dersefanu, which is in Larnaca, and I think they have 9 or 10.
Yes.
And there's a small center in Paphos, but we still don't have enough beds.
I was going to say, do we need more?
Well, it's 50 palliative...
It doesn't sound like a lot when we hear of so many patients, 4,000 patients.
The WHO organization says it's about 50 beds per million population.
Oh, I see.
So
all right.
We have to kind of go according to that. But palliative care should be provided to all chronic diseases. Right now, today we're
I was going to say, now this is what you're doing.
We'll talk about cancer today.
You're fundraising.
But now we've got a major model that other diseases can also copy for providing help to people with other, you know, it could be neurological disease, it could be heart disease, it could be all sorts of rare diseases.
Yes.
But people need to live with those rare diseases for their whole life.
The fundraising, where does the money go and what is it for?
Okay. So the fundraising, we're a charity, registered charity. So this week on Thursday, you'll see everybody with their yellow T-shirts in the streets. That's our major fundraising
event. Tomorrow,
the
11th of
yes.
April.
April, yeah. So that's in every city. And then on Sunday, we have our major march, which is the Christodoula March, and it's been happening since the early 70s.
Right.
So that's the one, our society, who's fundraising. Because even though we are now part of YESI, part of the general health system, it only basically covers about 30% of our expenses, and it doesn't cover all services either. So the inpatient facility has, we get reimbursed some of the money from ESE, and the home care services have now recently started being compensated by ESE. But overall, they probably cover about 30% of our, so we need to do the fundraising to raise the rest of the money.
Right.
Because we offer things that aren't even covered by ESE, so that's why it's there's quite a big gap.
For example?
I'm also responsible for the team of complementary therapists. So we provide to the inpatient group, the patients who stay, aromatherapy on a daily basis. It's, you know, a massage and using
aromatherapy,
yes,
oils and things. So that's, yes, also very
essential,
important
oils for both relaxation but also symptom control. So we've doing things that aren't always in.
So these are these special but a very important aspects which you cover through your fundraising. It's not that,
yes,
your fundraising is going towards administrative costs. I think so many people think that it goes to paying very high salaries. And that's,
I don't think any of the charities have very high salaries anyway. Mm. But you have a fleet of cars, for instance, because we have about 60 people at home care. You have, you know, a
and
lot of other things,
yes,
of course, uniforms and, like you say, administrative costs. And
is your team big enough to cover all the traveling, for example, to go and see patients who aren't able to come into you? Are there enough trained psychologists, counseling psychologists and clinical psychologists to help?
It's this, probably the smallest team of the psychologists, and we can't see every patient. So there's a quite...
Is there a backlog?
Yes, there's a, depending on which city as well. So we do supportive care. We're not going to go into a deep psychotherapy work with people. You support the family, you support the patient. It depends on, we'll visit every day the inpatients or have family meetings together with the social workers. Each of the other cities only have one psychologist and one social worker.
One.
So the teams are quite small.
One.
But we hope to expand that, yeah.
Why is the team
so... Well, they're
so...
in the smaller cities. The biggest team is in Nicosia because we have the inpatient facility as well, plus the home care. So needs fluctuate.
Yes.
And a lot of patients... might, you know, that's why we have a very large team of nurses. And now we're expanding our team of doctors, our team of psychologists, and our team of social,
yes,
workers.
I'm happy to hear that. Maintaining social relationships is also very difficult for cancer patients. Those who are young, single, maybe have delayed in initiation of romantic relationships. The family function is different. Can you talk to us also about how it affects employment, social isolation, avoidance?
Mm.
Many people...
Employment is a huge issue.
Yes.
And we are now striving for the right to forget. Because people who have gone through cancer have a lot of financial issues afterwards, being you know, given mortgages. And there's a huge initiative across Europe, which is this whole the right to forget. You don't need to be stigmatized just because you went through cancer, but you've been a survivor and you're going to be a survivor.
People are actually stigmatized. I'm shocked to hear that.
Well, it's really interesting, but... they're discriminated against because they might have had a cancer diagnosis or any, you know, life-threatening illness, and they're not given the same leeway as someone to get a mortgage, to get financial assistance, to get jobs because not everywhere. I don't want to make a blanket statement, but obviously it's a strong enough, it's a big enough issue that Europe has a huge task force right now, the European Cancer League, the ECL group, working on this particular initiative to get people back to work, to get people the same work opportunities, or if people are at work, to get they might need more leniency in terms of job descriptions, in terms
flexibility with their work hours, for example.
Yes.
Well, at least they're now covered.
To go to their appointments, and a lot of people.
New laws have allowed that, teleworking laws, which have come into play since the 1st of December.
But we do have a long way to go.
Yes.
I think the advocacy groups and the societies working with cancer patients, now there's a great organization with all of the societies together under one umbrella, and OSAC. And they're, I think, advocacy for the rights of patients, regardless of what they're suffering from.
Yes.
And conserving their professional identity. It's really important for someone who either they haven't had their first job yet, but they've done their studies, but then they had to kind of take a break because they were going through therapy.
Yes.
To be given all the opportunities that they would have been given despite a gap, because they had to do therapy. And then the older or middle-aged people who were already in the middle of their career, and then they had to go through their illness to just get back on track, and HR departments and employers really sit down and see what adjustments need to be made at work.
So there's quite a lot of social isolation. Do you find also that patients are describing that they have difficult conversations? People actually who haven't gone through cancer don't know what to say.
Yes, absolutely.
Can we talk a little about that?
Yeah.
If somebody's listening, they know of somebody who's recently been diagnosed with cancer. What does one say?
Yeah, it's often it's just not even knowing how to start. So it's important to acknowledge to the person, you know, I might not know what you're going through, but it must be really scary having this kind of, you know, diagnosis. And do you want to talk about it? Like, is there something that you want to discuss? It's up to the patient if they want to discuss it or not. But we need to acknowledge that and not go into fixer mode. I think
I'm so glad that you've said that. And so often people...
So first we ask for consent.
Yes.
Like, do you want to talk about it?
Yes.
And if it's not a good time, you know, I'd love to talk about it whenever you feel like it. We can go for coffee or we can talk on the phone.
Mm.
So you kind of establish that, you kind of normalize it.
Yes.
And you're saying, you're not saying, you know, I know everything and you should do this and you should do that. That's probably the worst mode to go into.
It's going to be okay.
Yes. You don't know if it's going to be okay.
No.
You can just show empathy by saying, you know, I don't really know what you're going through, but I can imagine you were shocked when it happened. And where are you at today?
Yes.
What's happening right now?
Follow-up conversations.
And then follow-up conversations, you always take the lead of the patient. So regardless where the patient wants to take it. And it's difficult because a lot of people don't actually demonstrate empathy because they're not listening. You're there to listen. You're not really there to give advice or to tell them, oh, my cousin did this and you should do that. And, you know, you should get a third and fourth and fifth opinion. Mm. This is very stressful for people. And unless they ask and they say, you know, I'm really confused. And what do you think about this and that? And then you can give an opinion. Or what is your opinion about this?
Yes.
Then they're inviting you to actually have a conversation and voice your opinion. But to demonstrate empathy, first you need to recognize what's going on with the person. You can say, you know, you look concerned today. What's going on?
Yes, not so, you look tired or you don't look well or something awful like
no,
that.
No, because they're probably feeling quite, they might be feeling insecure or their stress levels have gone up.
Yes.
And their window of tolerance has gotten very, very small. So they don't want to hear silly stuff. And then if the person says something like, yeah, you know, it was really scary to hear the doctor say this.
Mm.
You're kind of starting to recognize what the person might be feeling. So when they say something like, was scary, they're experiencing fear. That's true empathy, really understanding where the other person is at in the moment and what they're feeling.
Yes.
And then you can always validate what they're feeling. You can say, you know what, I don't know what it's like, but if I could imagine it, I think I'd be feeling the same thing you are. It sounds like there's a lot going on. And if you want us to just brainstorm about something, I'm here. Or if you want to go for a walk and not talk, I can just be there.
Yes.
Because a lot of times they don't want a lot of talk.
Listening rather than talking. It's very interesting. I was discussing this yesterday with a coach who said people simply don't listen.
No, people interrupt in the first 7 seconds.
Yes.
Of every conversation.
And I have to be honest, it seems to be also quite a Cyprus phenomenon that people interrupt. And you might even be having a conversation with somebody and a third person will just come and not even say, excuse me.
And barge into the conversation.
To somebody else's conversation, and you don't actually know those two people may be having a very deep and profound conversation at that time.
Have you experienced that?
Many times. From the mundane, you know, in a shop where you might be asking for a size of a shirt, to something very profound with a friend, and so somebody comes and interrupts.
I think going back to the comment of truly listening, because I think that's what I've been hearing for the last 15 years from our cancer patients, is that everybody has an opinion, everybody comes to the house and they start saying things that are not helpful.
Yes.
So maybe just, you know, stopping for a second and saying, you know, how can I be helpful to my friend or my family member? Maybe I should ask them what they need. And let them be who they are, not be, you know, this helicopter type of friendship, you know, eat this, do that, you should go to the gym. Oh, this happened to you because of this reason. Those are terrible things for any person diagnosed with anything.
It's a huge emotional distress, and it's not only the physical fight that they're having to get better, but this psychological distress, which can also bring about other mental health disorders. Which is the most common that you see, and what is your advice?
Okay, so we know that 1 in 3 cancer patients at some point in the cancer trajectory, because sometimes it might take, you know, just a few months, sometimes it might take a year to finish the therapy, sometimes it might take longer depending on which stage the person was diagnosed. 1 in 3 will have at some point clinical symptoms that will require professional handling.
Right.
So that's where we want the oncologists to be, and the GPs and whoever's taking care of the cancer patients, but also the family and also the individuals to recognize that it might be one of those time. So the main things that are clinical issues are depressive episodes.
Yes.
Anxiety. There might be a development of anxiety.
Sorry, I just want to interrupt. When you say depression, anxiety, we're not talking about one day you're feeling down. We're talking about a prolonged period.
An episode.
How can you?
Because you will have lots of days when you're feeling up and down and up and down.
All right.
Some days you'll be feeling yourself.
Yes.
Because it all depends on what therapy the person is undergoing.
Yes.
And therapy does have an effect on sleep, on appetite, everything affects mood.
So
and
when
affects
when you say an episode,
psyche.
You mean?
Yeah, I'm talking about clinical now. A clinical episode.
All right.
So if somebody is feeling every day for 2 weeks.
Okay.
A lower mood, and they know it's not their normal mood.
Yes.
Or it could be an anxiety episode, so hypervigilance, stress reactions, sleeplessness. It might be changes in behavior, so having a much lower tolerance and perhaps lashing out or feeling a lot of anger.
Right.
These can cause more anxiety and can cause a lot of mental health issues. So depression, anxiety are usually the most common. In the beginning of diagnosis, we also have quite a lot of people, not a lot of people, but a clinical issue that we need to be aware of is adjustment disorder. So
yes.
A person denying that they have a very serious diagnosis and denying that they need to go into treatment. So again, very difficult for the people around them to help them. And a lot of the times you need to call a psychologist, psychiatrist in the beginning. And then we also have, there's lots of other issues that can crop up.
Yes.
These are the main ones.
Yes.
And then post-traumatic stress after everything's finished.
Yes.
Sometimes post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic stress is not something abnormal. It's something normal, but we don't want it to turn into a disorder.
Yes.
So we don't want PTS to turn into PTSD.
PTSD.
But we have quite a high population, like up to 10%, even 10 years after the end of cancer treatments, and their survivors having post-traumatic stress symptoms, and they probably have a disorder. Even then, you can call up and say, I can't drive out past Bank of Cyprus Oncology without my stomach turning and wanting to vomit. That's a PTSD symptom. Or phobias, because perhaps before the diagnosis and this whole thing they had to go through, they weren't claustrophobic. But all of a sudden, because they had to do all those MRIs and everything, they've developed a phobia.
Yes.
Sometimes it's to needles. Sometimes it's to close spaces. It depends on what was happening at the time.
Right.
They were doing all that. They need professional help to deal with the phobia. So PTSD is never talked about. But once you've worked in the sector for a long time, you see the survivors who have developed. Even 10 years after, they still kind of have a trauma.
Yes.
That's trauma work that needs to be done. And it's very treatable, Saskia.
Yes.
PTSD is very treatable. They just need to ask for help.
Yes.
There's lots of new modalities,
It's hard to ask for help sometimes. So.
First, you need to recognize it. So if you're having flashbacks, or if you're having nightmares, or if you're driving outside of something, and it's recognize the triggers and then go talk to someone. They say, oh, you have PTSD.
Yes.
A lot of times we don't know. People don't know about clinical mental issues. So
yes.
Mental diagnosis. I don't know if I've covered your question.
You have. I also want to talk about some research, very interesting research done by Siwik Phillips and Zimaro in 2021, that certain cancers elucidate shame and guilt.
Really?
I'd love
for you to send me that research.
there was a link between smoking and lung cancer, which led to further depression because you have a certain guilty feeling. You know that you're not supposed to be smoking. Is this something that you've actually observed?
Absolutely.
Practice-based?
Absolutely. Or even cancer patients who are really struggling to either decrease, who are smokers, and they might not have lung cancer. They can have any cancer, and they still feel like it's something really, really difficult to tackle. So any kind of addiction, and if the patient has made a link to their diagnosis, will bring on very complicated feelings. It's not just guilt, it's anger, it's, you know, self-shaming. It's a lot of things that need someone to discuss and kind of, you know,
it's like a double whammy.
Desensitize all that.
It's not anxiety. Only the cancer, it's also the addiction.
Of course.
Because it's an addiction, it's also a problem.
Yes, it could be eating. It's not just smoking. It could be anything that you have a dependency on that may be interfering with, you know, you staying healthy.
Yes.
So a lot of this happening.
The treatment,
but I'd love to see that research if you can.
Yeah, I will. I will forward to it.
Because it's very recent. I'd love to read it.
It was very interesting.
It's an old issue, but a new research.
Yes. So. Treatment-related problems. We briefly covered the economic burdens that cancer patients have in Cyprus. Do we still have this traveling between Paphos and Limassol for Paphos patients?
No, there's no treatment in Paphos.
So they still have that added burden.
There's a private clinic, but for the major oncology centers, they travel from, most Paphians now go to the German Oncology Center or the, there's three now in Limassol. So most Paphians will go to the
So that's an added burden.
In Limassol. And it's the same for Larnaca. So most Larnaca residents will have to travel. They'll decide if they want to go to Limassol or Nicosia.
And yes. This is, do you think we should have treatment places in each city?
I don't know if I have an opinion on that, because I think we have a lot of treatment centers. And
so we
people
don't have,
in other countries, in developed countries, have to travel very far for oncological care.
Some, yes.
You know, for,
so we're not doing badly. I mean,
no,
it's good if we're actually
we're not doing
well
doing,
in
no, we're not
in
doing
some
badly.
Areas.
So if it's half an hour now, it used to be when it was only Nicosia, but now there's been a huge expansion in oncological care across the country. So I think Limassol, Nicosia are probably geographically what makes sense for for major centers. Because it's very, very expensive to have an oncological center with MRIs and with all these therapies.
Is there a long waiting list for people, or are they seen fairly quickly?
No, I don't think there's a long waiting list. Even though I don't work at the oncology center.
No.
I work at the palliative care center.
For those who've just, it's a good thing. For those who may have just tuned in, you know, that I'm speaking to counseling psychologist, Tina Rosido, head of the psychosocial services of the Cyprus Anti-Cancer Society. I also want to touch on caregivers, formal caregivers and the informal ones. What is the prevalence of depression and anxiety for them, the caregivers, and even some caregivers become patients themselves?
Mm.
They're looking after...
It's a good question. I mean, prevalence, I don't know how to say it in statistical terms, but it all depends on the relationship.
Yes.
And it all depends on the personalities. We've seen caregivers who... the symptoms would be mimicked. It's very, very interesting. Like when the wife was having chemo, the husband was feeling nauseous. We've seen that kind of connection, which is very, very interesting.
Yes.
When the wife was, and I'm talking about a certain couple now that we had for many years, and we took care of our patient, but in parallel, because they were very close, very close couple, and there was a lot of codependency. Of course, there was a lot of reaction to what was going on.
Yes.
So the mood, of course, they would affect one another. Now, I don't know about prevalence, to be honest, but each system, each family will often be along the same lines. So if the patient is not well or is depressed, and especially if they're clinically depressed,
yes,
yeah, the family's concerned, and of course it affects their mood. But I haven't seen that many systems where once one is diagnosed with clinical depression, then the system has clinical depression. They might have mood ups and downs.
Right.
But they also take on the role to try and keep the person going. They're trying to take care
uplifting.
Of them. Mm. Yes. Mm. And we're talking about functional systems because we also have dysfunctional systems that don't do so well sometimes under pressure.
Yes.
Because of their relationships not being that strong and not that supportive. We've seen all kinds. So if there's a healthy system, that's the best thing for the patient. And if the patient also wants the help, you know, some people are very independent. But it's an illness that for about a year, you're in and out of therapy, basically. So it's good to have a very good, strong support system. It could be family, it could be friends. Everybody's different. Everybody's at a different stage. Now, you talked about informal. Now, there's a huge impact on the family and financial impact. Because a lot of the times, the carers have to take a lot of time off, either for appointments or taking our patients to their therapy, but also caring for them at home. And I think not enough is being done there. So if any of our social workers were here, they always advocate for the family and the carers. And there's countries where they pay family members to take care of people who need help.
Right.
We're not there yet.
Okay.
Good to keep that
in mind.
Yeah.
What about the challenges faced by health professionals?
Working in with
that has to be incredibly distressing.
It's difficult in terms of it affects. I'm trying to think now. Inpatient, outpatient, cancer patients. I think the biggest impact is when people don't have very strong social networks. So a lot of the responsibility falls on the healthcare professional, whether it's the oncologist or the palliative care teams or the people who are providing services. Even though it's very rewarding in cancer care because you get a lot of positive feedback rather than other sectors, and people are genuinely thankful if you help them. Yes. So there's a lot of positive feedback. But there's still compassion fatigue, burnout, because of the rhythms of work and because of the 24-hour, you know, we have a 24-hour on-call service. So it's a very fast-paced with lots of needs. So, of course, our nurses, our doctors need care. They need to be to de-stress themselves. Mm.
There's been criticism that doctors, because of many factors, some which you've mentioned, and also the need for disattachment, are not sufficiently empathetic. Mm. We talked about empathy. How can better communication skills be implemented? And is there actually training for patient-orientated conversations?
Yes.
For example, how the prognosis is given, the medical terminology that they use.
Yeah, it's all about communication, I think, at the end of the day.
Yes.
I think most of the medical trainings now have incorporated clinical communication skills. So it's a skill. You can be trained. There are people who have natural empathy.
Yes.
But anybody can take a basic training in communication skills, in clinical communication skills, from the very first. And I think it should start from GPs all the way to
right.
to definitely oncologists, because oncologists might have the very difficult job of breaking bad news. It's a whole science how you break bad news.
Mm.
The University of Nicosia has an amazing program on clinical communication skills. And you should invite them to your program.
Yes.
They're amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's the... It's a great training program because it runs parallel with the medical training. So if you're an ace medical student, but you've done poorly in your clinical communication skills, they're not gonna give you your degree. You need to skill up.
Yes.
So they've designed it so well. And I don't know a lot about the other programs, but I know about the University of Nicosia Medical School program in clinical communication skills. And it's a 4-year stream. So they need to start from year one, start practicing how to speak to their patients.
Yes.
Lots of active listening and be able to do their job because doctors are under a lot of pressure. So you need to be an expert at communicating.
Yes.
Because you need to do it quickly
yes.
and with efficiency. Our organization went through a clinical communication skills training a few years back, and we need to do it again.
Right.
It's an ongoing thing.
Ongoing. Mm.
And it starts from listening to delivering information. So it's everything in between. You need to be able to organize and do very good family meetings. So communicate to the families, especially in the inpatient facility.
Yes.
So that's all communication, telling them the status, what's going on, or what therapy needs to be done, or all this. It's a science.
and this is what I wanted to ask in conclusion. It's multidisciplinary.
Yes.
Do you have sufficient psychosocial research done in Cyprus, and especially in this primary care? Do we have enough integrated data?
No, I don't think we have enough. I think we need more. One of our psychologists did some research on compassion fatigue
yes.
recently. She's a PhD colleague of mine with all the oncologists. There's a research being done right now by another colleague in one of the other societies on metastatic breast cancer patients, because their needs are completely different from non-metastatic breast
yes.
cancer patients. There's research being done. There's a lot of research being done at the asking patients about their needs.
Yes.
But I don't think there's enough, because there's not that big
the studies,
a group of psychosocial. We're just clinicians. We're running around trying to provide the services, and not enough people have the time to do the research that needs to be done.
It's been
the International Psycho Oncology Association, though, which is what we base ourselves under, has a ton of research.
Yes.
It's how you take that research from, other Western countries and do it locally as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Tina, thank you so much for being in the studio here with me today.